that the U.S. has a veto in the U.N. Security Council. Nikki Haley used it to block the Security Council criticism of the United States moving its embassy to Jerusalem. So there is value.
Oh, so you're pointing out that even though Nikki Haley sounded angry and expressed the anger of the United States, the United Nations didn't actually do anything in the end to the United States because the U.S. was able to block it.
Well, you know, it's sort of like the movie Casablanca, you know, to say I'm shocked that there's criticism of the United States and Israel and the UN is not exactly news. But it's worth thinking where the United States gets value. The U.S. spends a lot of money, and properly so, on defense around the world, but the U.N. helps share the burden by paying for peacekeeping missions all over the world so the United States doesn't have to shoulder it alone.
That sounds good, but let me just ask if this world body still makes sense. I just want to remember, for those who may not, that this organization was founded by the alliance that won World War II. It was seen as a way to make permanent that alliance that was going to dominate the world, and it was going to be led by the United States, and it made New York into the capital of the world, in a sense. That was the idea in 1945, in that period. Does the United Nations, as constructed, still make sense in the world as it has evolved today?
Well, one of the fundamental problems is it gives equal voice to countries that are dictatorships or have strongmen. And that was true from the very beginning with Stalin being given a permanent veto in the Security Council. But it's kind of rich from this administration where Haley's bosses, Trump and Tillerson, celebrate strongmen in Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Philippines. So them having a voice is not a surprise. The question is value for money. And places where the United States can use leverage of voluntary funding or get good burden sharing makes sense. You know, take an example. The World Health Organization has a lot of its funding from dues, and the United States has less of a voice. Mm. The Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, it's focused on particular epidemics. The U.S. has lots of leverage, and it gets other countries demonstrably to share the burden.
Oh, so when the United States puts up some money and gets other people to work with it, it actually has a huge voice at the United Nations.
It can. And the Global Fund is an example of an organization outside of the UN. Should look at other options. But the United States might well be shooting itself in the foot. The United States didn't go on the UN Human Rights Council in the late Bush administration, mm-hmm. but under Obama, in 6 years there, the number of resolutions on Israel went down from 60% to 40% to 20% of the resolutions.
Okay, so you can make a difference.
Maybe
if
being
you're
inside
there,
is better.
Mark Lagon, Ambassador, thank you very much.
You bet. Pleasure.
5 years ago, New Hampshire became the first state with an all-female congressional delegation. But women are still underrepresented in politics nationwide. They make up just 1 in 5 members of Congress. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben recently went to Manchester, New Hampshire, where women were getting trained in the basics of campaigning for office.
I want you to think to yourself, I'm a candidate. And when you're a candidate, you begin to collect people.
On a Saturday morning, Kate Coyne McCoy is in a small conference room with an audience of 26 women. She's a trainer with the Democratic group Emily's List. And she's explaining what fires her up to do this job.
I wake up sort of every day. The first thing I do is look at this list of members of Congress that I have, and I figure out who's sick and who's going to die. Because I want to replace them with you.
McCoy has been training candidates since 2001. Today, a big part of that training is encouragement.
I believe that the country's going to hell in a clutch purse and that you are the answer.
Trainings like this one have proliferated in the last year. In 2016, prior to Election Day, just 1,000 women even reached out to Emily's List saying they were interested in running for office. Since Election Day, 25,000 women have reached out to the group. And this year, Emily's List has already trained 2,500 women. On top of that, still other groups dedicated to training women candidates have sprouted around the country. Deborah Altshuler is one of this morning's attendees. She has already won an election to New Hampshire's State House in 2016.
Every blind squirrel gets a nut every once in a while, and I wanted to make sure that it wasn't just me as a blind squirrel. I knew that I had done some of the right things, but you know, I was making it up as I went along. And so was our team.
Altshuler already heard lessons today on how to work a room, talk to voters, and prepare her family for a campaign. But she's also looking forward to improving her fundraising skills.
Asking for money is not my forte. So I need to learn how to do that more effectively. I did do it. I was wildly uncomfortable doing it, but I did it, and there's got to be a better way to do that.
Altshuler and the two dozen others here this morning are part of a much larger uptick in women's political involvement. The number of women candidates for the U.S. House alone has nearly doubled its 2016 level, according to Debbie Walsh. She's the director of the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers University.
This is a surge. We're seeing it in the House. We're seeing it in the Senate. We're also seeing it for governor. This is unprecedented, and it is real.
Walsh helps her organization run bipartisan trainings, but she says this surge is overwhelmingly among Democrats. To her, the reason for this wave? Well, it's pretty obvious.
The outcome of the 2016 presidential election, both the combination of Hillary Clinton losing and Donald Trump getting elected.
Again and again, women coming here cited Donald Trump's election. For Altshuler, the allegations of sexual assault and other misconduct against Trump, allegations he has denied, are a big part of her drive.
I mean, there can't be any larger motivation.
Shelby Gazzetta is a teacher who lives in Boston and has never run for office. She says she took Hillary Clinton's loss especially hard, and she remembers the conversation among her girlfriends the night after the election.
As we were talking to each other, like consoling each other, and we started talking about, like, well, why don't more women run? And, like, why couldn't you run or why couldn't I run? And I think that was kind of just like a moment for me where it kind of planted the seed.
Encouragement from other people is important in getting women to run for office, Debbie Walsh said. She points to research suggesting that a big reason why women are underrepresented in politics is that they simply don't run as often as men.
We've consistently found that the men are more likely to wake up one morning, look in the mirror, and say they'd be a great elected official. And the women are more likely to say that they ran the first time because somebody recruited them.
Gazzetta just might be a case study in how well recruitment can work. The night before the training, she was thinking it might be 6 years or more before she ran for office. She wanted to move back to Indiana, where she's from, and finish law school first. But just partway through the training, that was changing.
Given some of the presentations, I've been thinking maybe I want to get involved sooner than I was originally thinking. Maybe even, you know, in the next couple of years, and then kind of see where that goes.
If trainings like this are effective, they won't just inspire women like Gazzetta to run. They'll teach them how to win. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, Manchester, New Hampshire.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:18, and you have tuned in to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. NPR headlines are coming up next, and then during the WPR newscast, two frac sand mining companies with ties to western Wisconsin are merging. WPR's Rich Kramer tells us why in a few minutes.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, featuring Cottontail Bath and Body Shop, inviting you to pamper your skin with a variety of handmade body care products, including body butters, lip balms, bath bombs, and much more. The market is open Saturdays at the Rody from 10 until 2.
Evergreens. WPR is pleased to promote family-friendly events. For more information, go to WPR.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Extremely cold weather is gripping much of the northern U.S. from Montana to New England. Temperatures are below zero in some areas, and wind chill warnings and advisories are posted. It's more than 20 degrees below zero in northern Minnesota. It's minus 12 in northern Maine. In Erie, Pennsylvania, NPR's Alyssa Nadworny says they're measuring this week's snowfall by the foot.
The snow is waist deep here. In just 2 days, more than 50 inches of snow has fallen in Erie. It shattered local and state records, and folks here are bracing for more.
The Pentagon is facing a federal lawsuit filed by three cities over the U.S. military's failure to report service members disqualified from gun ownership to the FBI's national background check system. This follows November's deadly shooting at a Baptist church in Texas. It left 26 people dead. German authorities are investigating what caused a Swiss tourist ship to run into a bridge pylon on the Rhine River in the west of the country. Here's NPR's Soraya Sarhadi-Nelson.
27 people were injured when the Swiss Crystal struck the highway bridge near the city of Duisburg. The German news agency DPA says the 330-foot-long tourist vessel was headed for the Netherlands. There were 103 passengers and 26 crew members on board. Authorities say those who were injured were treated and released.
I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. Two of the nation's foremost producers of frac sand have announced a merger that will create a massive new mining company with operations in Wisconsin. Rich Kramer reports.
Connecticut-based Uniman and Ohio-based Fairmont Santrol will combine to form a single publicly traded company by summer of next year. Both have sand mines in Menominee, Maiden Rock, and Tunnel City. Company officials weren't available for comment, but a joint statement said Fairmont shareholders will get a $170 million cash payment and a 35% ownership stake in the new company. Uniman's parent company, Belgium-based Sibelco, will own the rest of the new business. It's anticipated the merger will be complete by next summer. Fairmont and Uniman say their combined operations will be capable of producing 45 million tons of sand each year, with more than a billion tons of reserves. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin is expected to finish the year with freezing temperatures and dangerously high wind chills. The Wisconsin State Journal reports that the state went into a deep freeze early yesterday morning. Wind chills reached 20 below in Madison, but areas in northern Wisconsin experienced even colder wind chills, as low as 40 below in Rhinelander. The National Weather Service has issued a wind chill advisory through this morning for Wisconsin. Wind chills could range from 10 to negative 35 below. Temperatures can cause frostbite to exposed skin within 30 minutes. You're listening to WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Sony Pictures Classics with Call Me By Your Name, about a young American's summer of romance with a grad student in Italy, starring Armie Hammer, Timothy Chalamet, and Michael Stuhlbarg, now playing select cities. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, presenting After the Fact, a new podcast from Pew that explores facts, numbers, and trends shaping the world. More information is available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. From Indeed.com, used by over 3 million businesses for hiring, where business owners and HR professionals can post job openings, then review candidates, take notes, and schedule interviews from an online dashboard. Learn more at Indeed.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noelle King. And this next story is about something we think about a lot at Morning Edition. It's about sleep. It's actually about the lack of sleep. Decades ago, a teenage boy named Randy Gardner stopped sleeping for 11 nights. And because of that, scientists were able to learn something about the price we pay when we don't get enough rest. NPR's Shankar Vedantam has the story.
Our story begins in 1963 when Randy Gardner moved to San Diego. He was 17. It was the last in a long line of childhood moves.
I'm the oldest of four siblings in a military family.
In every town he lived in, Randy entered the science fair.
I was a kind of a science nerd when I was young. When we came to this town, San Diego, I thought, boy, this is a big city.
If he wanted to win the science fair here, he'd have to pull out all the stops. The idea he came up with? Going without sleep for 264 hours, exactly 11 days. Long enough to break a world record. He recruited two of his friends,
Bruce McAllister and Joe Marciano,
and asked them to stay awake on rotations around the clock to help him stay awake.
If you're on your own, you're going to succumb. You're going to fall asleep.
The first 2 days were easy. He stayed away from beds and tried to stand as much as he could. But on day three,
I noticed that in the morning, I was really nauseous. And that's when I stumbled on eating citrus for some reason. Tangerines or oranges seemed to take the nausea away.
Did you start to feel like your mental faculties were slipping, that it was harder to answer questions, it was harder to remember something, to formulate a phrase or a sentence?
I mean, it was crazy, where you couldn't remember things. It was kind of almost like an early Alzheimer's thing brought on by lack of sleep.
A few days into the Wake-a-thon, a sleep researcher from Stanford University showed up. His name, and this will feel like a pun, was William Dement.
And he rented a car, a convertible, and we drove around in that. So we had a really good time when Dr. Dement came down. That really helped me, because that was like a fresh of something different and new to keep me going.
At 2 o'clock in the morning on January 8, 1964, Randy broke the world record. He had gone 11 days, 264 hours, without drifting off. There was only one way to celebrate. He was whisked off to a naval hospital where researchers attached electrodes to his head to monitor his brain waves, and he went to sleep. How long did you sleep?
I slept just over 14 hours. I remember when I woke up, I was groggy, but not any groggier than a normal person.
And did you find that over the next several days or weeks, you needed extra sleep?
No, not at all. I went right back to the regular mode, and everything was fine. Strange, isn't it?
Randy's sleep project earned him and his friends first place in the 10th annual Greater San Diego Science Fair. It also ushered in a lifetime of fame. This is sound from the popular 1960s TV game show, To Tell the Truth. The show brings together four celebrity panelists.
Tom Poston, Peggy Cass.
The panelists face three people who all claim to be the same person.
What is your name, please?
My name is Randy Gardner.
My name is Randy Gardner.
The panelists have to guess which one was the real Randy. On the show, the real Randy Gardner is number two. He wears dark, horn-rimmed glasses, his hair swoops to the left, he's soft-spoken and direct when answering questions.
14 hours and 43 minutes.
And did you feel loud?
Most of the panelists figured out that this Randy was a real Randy.
Kitty Carlisle.
I voted for number two because he looks the sleepiest.
Such a path to fame is no longer possible. The Guinness Book of World Records has done away with the category of going without sleep because of the health dangers of severe sleep loss.
That's right.
This is UC Berkeley neuroscientist Matthew Walker. He says if your idea of being sleep-deprived is days on end without enough rest, think again.
Even just the smallest amount of insufficient sleep, we see health consequences. And I think perhaps, you know, one of the best examples of that small perturbation is one of the largest sleep experiments ever done. It's been performed on 1.6 billion people. It happens twice a year, and it continues to happen. It's called daylight savings time. And in the spring, when we lose an hour of sleep, we see a subsequent 24% increase in heart attacks. In the fall, when we gain an hour of sleep opportunity, there is a 21% decrease in heart attacks.
Many of us think that if we get extra sleep one night, we can afford to lose a bit of sleep the next. But Matthew says there is a reason this sort of sleep credit system doesn't exist.
So there were times in evolution when we would have feast, and there were times when there was famine. And we designed a system to come up and store that caloric credit, and so that we could spend it when there was a debt in place. Why don't we have that with sleep? Why aren't there some brain cells that can actually build up sleep credit? What that means is that Mother Nature has never faced, throughout the course of evolution, the challenge of this thing called sleep deprivation.
To Randy Gardner, sleep deprivation is no longer something with which he wants to experiment.
About 10 years ago, I stopped sleeping. I could not sleep.
He was convinced his teenage stunt was to blame.
That's why I keep calling this some karmic payback for, you know, my body going, okay, buddy. Yeah, okay, 11 days without sleep when you know damn well you need sleep. Well, let's try this out for size.
Randy says going without sleep changed him.
I was awful to be around. Everything upset me. It was like a continuation of what I did 50 years ago.
Finally, after years of unbearable insomnia, Randy made an uneasy peace with sleep. He's regained the ability to drift off, but only for about 6 hours a night.
You have to have sleep. It's It's as important as, it's the big three. I call it the big three: water, food, sleep. You got to have them, all of them.
Randy Gardner, the man who conquered sleep, is now terrified of going a night without it. Shankar Vedantam, NPR News.
Shankar Vedantam is the host of NPR's Hidden Brain podcast. This is NPR News.
One Seattle nonprofit thought it was doing a good job helping foster youth in school. Then the numbers came out.
Our high school graduation rate here in King County on time, 36%.
For kids in foster care.
I'm Robert Siegel. How an organization called Treehouse turned that number around. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Don't miss All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 today here on WPR.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and coming up this hour still, it's Wisconsin Life. Today, we'll reflect on a grandfather's hands. That's Wisconsin Life in 15 minutes. Good morning. It is 8:30. I'm Maureen McCollum in Wisconsin Public Radio News. Harley-Davidson is placing a renewed emphasis on teaching people to ride as part of its efforts to attract more customers. The Milwaukee-based company's decision to expand the number of dealerships with a Harley Riding Academy comes as the industry grapples with years of declining sales and an aging customer base. The program launched in 2000 with about 50 locations. Now, 245 dealerships in the U.S. offer the 3 or 4 day course. The company says about a quarter of those launched since 2014. Harley sold close to 125,000 new motorcycles during the first 9 months of this year. That's down from more than 135,000 motorcycles during the same period last year. The Motorcycle Industry Council says the median age of motorcycle owners increased from 32 to 47 years old since 1990. Surveillance video led La Crosse police to an arson suspect who's accused of setting an apartment building on fire. The 62-unit complex had to be evacuated last Friday in the middle of the night. The video showed 43-year-old Edward Foster entering the first-floor trash room where the fire started. Police say Foster claimed he was home all night at first, but changed his story when he saw the video. This is WPR.
Morning Edition. Classical music. Wisconsin Life. These programs and many more are possible thanks to listener support. You can learn more about WPR programs, schedules, and so much more at WPR.org. Thank you.
Support comes from the App Factory at UW Parkside. Is your business or nonprofit in need of a mobile app? Student interns at the App Factory make state-of-the-art and user-friendly apps for phones and other mobile devices. Web applications, too. For more information, visit appfactory.uwp.edu.
It's going to be incredibly cold again today across Wisconsin. The entire state is under a wind chill advisory this morning, as wind chills will range from negative 15 to negative 35. Frostbite and hypothermia are possible if proper precautions are not taken.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from American Jewish World Service, working together for more than 30 years to build a more just and equitable world. Learn more at ajws.org. From Charles Schwab, offering Schwab Intelligent Advisory, an interactive online financial planning service that combines technology with personal advice. Learn more at schwab.com/intelligentadvisory. And from the William T. Grant Foundation at wtgrantfoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. How much has the Trump administration really changed public education? A tax bill includes a huge break for parents of private school students. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos has made several high-profile moves in recent months. And so we're going to talk through all of the results with Anya Kamenetz of the NPR Ed team. Hi, Anya.
Hi, Steve.
Having watched the administration in action for a while now, do you feel you understand their broad goals for education?
As soon as Betsy DeVos was appointed, people in the education world kind of knew what the playbook was going to be, because she has a long history in Michigan and elsewhere of backing two big areas. Of course, school choice. Everyone's heard her advocacy for private schools, sometimes religious schools and for-profit schools. And at the same time, kind of a culture war element. And that has to do with the use of the education department as a little bit of a bully pulpit, which really has been its strength over the decades.
Okay, so a couple of things to follow up on there. Let's talk about choice first, which often gets down to money. Which schools are receiving federal funds? How much progress has DeVos made in pushing money the way she'd like?
Well, until recently, we didn't see big, massive federal policy changes. There were some things in the budget request that came out earlier this spring that would have directed hundreds of millions of dollars to private schools and charter schools, but that was pretty much ignored by Congress. Hmm. So it wasn't until this tax bill that just passed that we saw the beginnings of what may be directing more resources toward private schools. And that's something you alluded to at the top, which was the use of 529 plans, college mm-hmm. savings plans, which really are the province of the wealthy. Not many people have that much money to save, but 529 college savings plans can now be used for private schools. On the other side of the ledger, the change in the state and local tax deduction has a lot of public school advocates worried that it's going to be harder to fund public schools and especially harder to fund them equitably.
Now, what about the culture war?
Well, you know, some would say that, you know, the Obama administration's education department pursued a certain vision, and that was done oftentimes through these dear colleague letters or guidance. And mm-hmm. One of the most high-profile changes of the year was when DeVos walked back the transgender rights guidance. And this had to do with the ability of students to access the bathrooms of their choice.
The Obama administration offered one opinion to schools, which it couldn't necessarily enforce absolutely, but it gave guidance. And now the Trump administration is giving different guidance?
Exactly. And as a result of that, actually, the case of Gavin Grimm was not heard by the Supreme Court because of this change in direction.
Gavin Grimm, remind us, that's a student.
Gavin Grimm was a student in Virginia who sued the school district for the right to use the bathroom of his gender identity.
Are there other cases where the Trump administration has spoken out on issues in ways that have influenced public education across the country?
Sure. So, you know, in the higher education realm, but K-12 as well, we heard a lot about the rollback of sexual assault guidance. That was also coming from the idea that Title IX covered sexual assault victims. And Betsy DeVos has really pushed for a notion of the rights of the accused and due process rather than just emphasizing the rights of victims. And that has led to a real firestorm.
Does the education world feel different then after almost a year of the Trump administration because of the things you've just described?
I think it does for a lot of reasons, not just the reasons I've described. But, you know, when you go to schools, we have a very diverse public school population. One figure commonly cited is that 1 in 4 young students has an immigrant parent. Hmm. And so surveys show, and my reporting shows, that there is a feeling of oftentimes anxiety and especially polarization because of the rhetoric of the Trump administration around minority rights, around civil rights, around immigrants' rights.
So students, at least some students, are more tense.
That's right. We reported on a survey that said 79% of teachers nationwide said their kids were concerned about their well-being, and more than half of them were stressed and anxious compared to prior years.
Anya, thanks very much. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Steve.
That's Anya Kamenetz of the NPR Ed team.
Before Hurricane Maria devastated the island of Vieques in Puerto Rico, it was a big tourist destination. It was best known for its glowing bay. Mosquito Bay is home to one of the world's brightest bioluminescent bays. NPR's Merritt Kennedy took a trip there to look for signs of recovery.
On a normal night, there would be dozens of tourists in this mangrove-lined cove named after a legendary pirate ship. Tonight, it's just us.
Go ahead and look over on the right.
We paddle out on kayaks with Angie Hernandez, a guide for the Vieques-based ecotourism company Blackbeard Sports. The sky is filled with stars. Something streaks overhead.
I saw that as well. It was really bright. It was a shooting star.
But tonight, we're looking down at the water for glowing creatures called dinoflagellates. These single-celled plankton light up when they are disturbed. Scientists think it's a defense mechanism. The species found here glows blue-green, and it's called Pyrodinium bahamense, a.k.a.
the whirling fire of the Bahamas.
When the hurricane hit, Maria doused the saltwater bay with fresh water, impacting its delicate chemistry. And the storm's winds were so strong, they may have pushed water and the dinoflagellates out of the bay.
We have there just sort of like the mechanical of whoosh, you know, flushing.
And it can take time for them to accumulate once again. Mark Martin Brass is the director of research for the Vieques Conservation and Historical Trust, which takes weekly samples to monitor the bay. The situation provides an opportunity, he says, to learn more about how this ecosystem deals with powerful hurricanes. And it's also a reminder.
The attraction of this island and the power of it comes from the natural things, and you want to protect them rather than exploit them.
After other hurricanes, it reportedly took months before the bay started glowing again, Hernandez says. And for weeks after Maria, it was dark. But tonight, the bay is once again showing some light.
Real quick, look over your right-hand side and dip your paddle in.
Oh, it's a lot.
It's a lot over here. It is a lot brighter. Like, I'm pushing the paddle forward, and you're able to see a ball, like a formation of light.
When you stick your hand in the water, it glitters and glows with tiny individual flickers of light, like diamonds.
Dinoflagellates are a girl's best friend.
Life after Maria has been extremely difficult. Hernandez went for weeks without regular running water, and she's only had a handful of tours come through. But tonight, she can see the bay is coming back.
It's seeing this now, you know, after seeing it diminish and seeing it now, this gives me a lot of hope.
It's at a fraction of its usual brightness, but there are definitely signs of life. Merritt Kennedy, NPR News, Vieques, Puerto Rico.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:41, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in on this chilly and very cold Wednesday morning. We'll bring you headlines next from NPR and WPR. After that, it's Wisconsin Life.
Wisconsin Public Radio and Burkhalter Travel are sponsoring a 10-day Nashville to New Orleans musical heritage tour in April. Day 7 takes place in Louisiana with a stop at Frogmore Plantation. Then, after a tour of the Louisiana Delta Music Museum, it's off to Lafayette to Martin Accordions to learn the history of accordion making and hear the Martin family tell stories and play music. Details on the April 20th through 29th tour are at wpr.org/travel.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Turkey's president is describing Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad as a terrorist who's killed close to a million of his citizens. NPR's Peter Kenyon says the remarks came during a visit to North Africa.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan appeared at a joint news conference with the Tunisian president and addressed the Syrian conflict, saying, quote, Assad is definitely a terrorist who has carried out state terrorism. Erdogan says it's impossible to move forward with a peace plan for Syria while Assad remains in power. UN peace efforts have so far failed.
Japan's foreign minister is dismissing any attempts by the South Korean government to revise an agreement designed to help South Korean women who were forced to work in Japanese military brothels during World War II. Japan's chief cabinet secretary, Yoshihide Suga, spoke about the agreement today while in Seoul.
The agreement reached last year resolving the issue of comfort women was finally and irreversibly confirmed between the two countries of Japan and South Korea. It is highly appreciated by the international community. It is extremely important that this agreement be steadily implemented.
Suga was heard here through a BBC interpreter. Stocks are higher this morning on Wall Street. At last check, the Dow was up 3 points, the S&P up 2, the Nasdaq up 6 points. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. The Superior City Council signed off on a recommendation this fall to allow police to kill problem birds in the city. Daniel Kading reports the move aims to stem their increasing numbers.
Superior cops can now shoot nuisance waterfowl, geese, and pigeons on public and private property with the owner's permission. Superior Parks and Rec Director Linda Cadott says a couple businesses reached out to police after confronting problems with geese.
And indicated that their power lines were being knocked out,
their grain was being pillaged by geese and having some extreme population density issues affecting their business.
There are around 158,000 Canada geese in Wisconsin. That number is up 22% from last year, according to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Cadotte says one city beach was closed more than it was open due to E. coli from waterfowl. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A fired food service worker is charged with ramming other vehicles at Lambeau Field in Green Bay last week. 40-year-old Che Vang was charged yesterday with two felony counts of first-degree recklessly endangering safety and five misdemeanor counts of damage to property. USA Today Network Wisconsin reports Vang's cash bond was set at $10,000. According to the complaint, Vang was working for Delaware North at Lambeau when he got into a fight with a coworker during a Packers game earlier this month. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from LogMeIn, makers of GoToMeeting, a collaborative meeting platform committed to helping get work done in today's modern workforce. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. From Heather Sturt Haga and Paul G. Haga, supporting African Wildlife Foundation, working to ensure wildlife and wild lands thrive in modern Africa. Learn more at awf.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, at WTGrantFoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
We've all been there. Dry, chapped hands. Winter and skin are not the best of friends. But the season of bloody fingers made Mike Paulus think of his grandfather and all that his grandfather's hands had allowed him to do.
The skin on my knuckles has been dry and cracked for weeks. My fingertips, too. I've got little scabs from all the little places my skin has split open, little drops of blood seeping through. It hurts to type. I literally bled as I wrote a sentence. I blame the parched winter air. Maybe I should wear gloves when I wash the dishes. Maybe I should stick them in my pockets when I scurry outside to start the minivan. And that reminds me, late in life, my grandfather ended up with these big, knobby wooden spoons for hands, stiff and gnarly. The skin had been worn thin from 80 years of really grabbing onto things. He grabbed onto hammers and rammed nails deep into 2x4s, framing up entire houses. If a board didn't look level, he'd just give it a heavy slap and say, "We ain't building a piano." But I'm pretty sure that the board was always level. He grabbed onto the barrels of shotguns and hunting rifles, pushing shells into their chambers. He pulled their stocks tight against his shoulder and picked out animals through clumps of trees, across dead fields crusted over with snow. And most of the time, it was legal. He grabbed onto the handles of spatulas and frying pans while he and Grandma ran their bakery, diner, and drive-in. He cooked food for the people of Danbury, Webster, and Siren, just like he did on a ship full of sailors out in the Pacific Ocean as World War II stormed over Europe. One time, he grabbed a pipe from behind the counter and smashed in the nose of a violent, drunk customer. And afterward, he drove that guy to the hospital. One bright summer afternoon, he used those hands, which had grown chunky and graceless towards the end, to cradle my newborn daughter. He died later that year. Here's the last thing I remember about my grandfather's hands. He used to lean over in his favorite recliner and let one arm dangle as he talked. His hand would bounce up and down the side of the chair like he was jigging for bluegills. His fingertips tickled the upholstery. Aimless. I think his bent old paws were testing their cage. They were penned up in here in this house. They wanted to slap nails into some wood. They wanted to pull triggers. They wanted to slam shut the door of his old pickup truck and go somewhere, anywhere. I am not a fidgety person. I'm able to sit perfectly still for hours on end, my hands resting at my sides. I can rip into a laptop keyboard, and I can handle a pair of chopsticks. But my hands just don't do what my grandfather's did. The skin cracks because it's cold outside, and I'm too lazy to put on gloves. It happens every year, the cracked skin and the blood. I wince at the pain. Well, maybe someday I'll grab onto something and earn the blood on my knuckles.
Mike Paulus is a writer and the online editor of Volume 1 in Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
And it's almost 9 o'clock, 10 minutes till 9 o'clock, and this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us on this Wednesday morning. Coming up next on Morning Edition, we'll talk about the top sports stories of 2017. See if yours made the list next here on Morning Edition.
WPR's old-time radio drama is coming to Wausau. Hi, I'm Norman Gilliland. Join me and the 9XM Players for a family-friendly performance of Oscar Wilde's Canterville Ghost at UW Marathon County on February 9th. Experience the golden age of radio with period costumes, sound effects, live music, and more. Find details at wpr.org/ghost.
It's going to be a painfully cold day today across Wisconsin. All of the state is under a wind chill advisory this morning, with wind chills between negative 15 to negative 35. Frostbite and hypothermia can occur if precautions are not taken, so do be sure to bundle up.
Support for WPR comes from the UW-Madison Mead Witter School of Music, offering personalized musical training in the heart of Wisconsin's capital city. Information is available at music.wisc.edu.
Support for WGTD comes from Carthage College, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We're near the end of a year when the wall between sports and the rest of the news crumbled. People would like to think of sports as an escape. It's never entirely so. Sports reflect a changing society. Just think of the triumph of Jackie Robinson in a segregated America. Or think of Muhammad Ali refusing the draft during Vietnam. We brought in two of our favorite sports writers to talk through the way sports have again become a battleground for national events. Christine Brennan writes a column for USA Today, and Kevin Blackistone writes for The Washington Post. So we asked both of you to nominate some sports stories that reflect the world beyond the playing field. And Kevin, why don't you go first?
Well, I thought one was Donald Trump and how he went on an attack against athletes and sports almost all year long, in particular black athletes like Colin Kaepernick and the protests that he carried out with the anthem and the flag as a backdrop.
And let's remember, Colin Kaepernick began this protest relating to the national anthem before Donald Trump was president. This has been going on for a while.
Exactly. Been going on since 2016, and it's a protest against police lethality against unarmed black men in this country.
Christine, what do you make of the fact that Kaepernick has been unable to play the entire season?
Well, that is unfortunate, because you would have thought, especially after Trump inserted himself into this story in late September in the Alabama Senate race, of all things, and while the reaction was extraordinary, hundreds of players protesting that week and then the next and the next, I really thought at that point that a team might pick up Kaepernick.
But I think, you know, the interesting thing is that Kaepernick got a lot of support over the year. He wound up on the cover of GQ. SI gave him the Muhammad Ali Award. His jersey, still one of the top-selling jerseys in the league. So a lot of people did not turn him off and, in fact, embraced his protest.
And I think history will judge. I mean, in 50 years, when kids are studying our cultural history at this time, Kaepernick and that protest is going to be a part of what they're studying.
Isn't this just one of several ways that the president has found sports to be a battlefield for him?
Absolutely. I mean, we saw his attack on the Golden State Warriors when Steph Curry said that he didn't want to visit the White House, which has become become a routine for championship teams.
And the Warriors coach Steve Kerr has been critical of the president and some of his policies.
Absolutely. And then LeBron James hopped into the fray and tweeted that the president was a bum. Jamel Hill on ESPN came out and tweeted that Donald Trump was a white supremacist, which caused a furor at ESPN, and the network was attacked, and they had to suspend her, and she had to issue an apology. So, it's been sports politicized like we've never seen before.
What's another way that sports have intersected with the news?
Well, the Me Too movement. We saw it with the star gymnasts, Allie Raisman, Michaela Maroney, Gabby Douglas, all of them talking about the sexual abuse that they suffered as gymnasts while they were winning medals for the nation, that were everyone's cheering for them. So troubling, and USA Gymnastics and what they didn't do.
This has got to be especially troubling throughout sports because people play so young and may be on a national stage or traveling or whatever, so young.
Well, and also Olympic teams. So, for example, the U.S. Swimming has had this issue for a long time, and the U.S. Olympic Committee is finally starting something called Safe Sport, a center to try to have a clearinghouse for this. But it's an ongoing problem.
Are there corners of the sporting world that have tried to be a leader on this issue?
Certainly, women's sports that are led by women in the aftermath of the birth of Title IX, I think we've seen it there. But it's interesting that so many of these sports are sports involving women that are led by men, or are men's sports in which women work and have had to face these problems of harassment as well as discrimination and, in some instances, straight-out assault.
I would say a positive, though, that we've seen recently is the Jerry Richardson story.
Right.
So Jerry Richardson, the owner of the Carolina Panthers, former NFL player, he's the founder of the Panthers, and an incredibly damning, troubling story by Sports Illustrated, at least four issues where he settled with female employees, awful comments, wanting women to be in his car, and then he would seatbelt them in, massages, just on and on it goes. And that story broke on a Friday, and by Sunday he was basically done, and Monday he officially left the team. That's the owner of the team, gone within 72 hours.
Kevin, I know there's a somewhat different issue involving women that's on your mind because of a star tennis player.
Serena Williams, what a year she had. For an athlete, for a human being, and specifically for women as an example. She won the Australian Open while pregnant. She would later give birth to a healthy baby. She had many of us discussing whether or not she's not the GOAT, the greatest athlete of our time. Still active today. She's in her...
That would be Goot, I think. G-O-O-T. But anyway, go on. I'm sorry. Didn't mean to...
And then I thought she did something really interesting that kind of went overlooked. Maria Sharapova wrote a memoir in which she took some shots at Serena Williams, criticizing Serena Williams' body type. Thick legs, big arms, that sort of thing. And Serena Williams responded by writing an open letter to her mother, Serena Williams' mother, in which part of it, she celebrated her look. She celebrated the black aesthetic when it comes to the female body. And I thought that that was really reassuring. I thought it was affirming of black beauty. And I thought it was an important thing for her to do for the girls who look up to her.
Well, and Kevin, when you think about it, you know, Serena is 36 and Venus, her sister's 37, and they're still winning or in the finals of Grand Slam events this past year. It's an extraordinary run. We will never see anything like it again. They have been tremendous role models for our daughters and our nieces and the girl next door. We should all be thanking the Williams sisters.
Is there one more occasion you could name where sports have collided with the news?
Well, I will say this, and a real positive, Houston. When you look at the city of Houston, Steve, obviously Hurricane Harvey, the devastation. Who doesn't remember the pictures of the water up to the signs on the interstate? Just horrifying. And then the turnaround within a few weeks, the Houston Astros baseball team, the team that was so lousy a few years ago, and yet that experiment, Sports Illustrated calling it 3 years ago, saying this is going to be the World Series champ in 2017. And lo and behold, it happens, and Houston wins. Sports as a feel-good, sports as this, sometimes it sounds like a cliche, brings us together. Well, in this case,
sometimes it does.
It does.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
Christine Brennan of USA Today, thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve.
And Kevin Blackstone of The Washington Post, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noel King.
And you can hear Morning Edition Monday through Friday, 5 to 9, here on Wisconsin Public Radio. If you want to follow news throughout the day, that's statewide, national, and global news, you can go to our website, WPR.org. Stay tuned. Classical music and headlines are coming up next.
Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Dells, indoor water parks and theme parks, dining and entertainment. More information about holiday happenings is at wisdells.com. Wisconsin Dells, the water park capital of the world.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Rhea, with homemade soups, salads, and sandwiches being served daily at their historic soda fountain. Stop by Jack and Rhea today for lunch and an old-fashioned soda. JackandRhea.com.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha,